From historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, this is The Seminary Explores. Conversations about people, politics, theology, and life. Welcome to The Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giedenhain with Seminary Ridge Review. My guest is Irish poet Michal O'Shiel. His collected poems was just published by Blood Axe Books this fall. Michal, welcome to The Seminary Explores.
Thank you very much.
You wear a kind of accidental mantle of being a theologian's poet, partially because of your friendship with theologians. Would you like to tell us something about that?
Well, yes, as you say, it's partly an accident insofar as that my best friend for 48 years since my time in Trinity College Dublin is David Ford, who is one of the leading Anglican theologians. He's professor in Cambridge, and we have been best friends and first readers for one another all those years. So quite obviously, his love of poetry has been one of the factors, but then I have followed all his work and therefore have been deeply involved with a lot of theologians. So it's partly accidental, but it's not entirely accidental in the sense that I would quote my favorite of all Irish poets, of modern Irish poets, for to say it that way, Patrick Kavanagh, who once said that any poet worth his salt was a theologian. Mm-hmm. And so you ask what that means, or why did he say that? And I think it's not anything to do particularly with religion or that. What it really, I think, comes down to is that poets and theologians are asking questions about meaning. We're trying to make sense of the world, trying to understand how things fall together in the world. And that, I think, is very much in common, indeed, to my mind, between any artist and any theologian, mm-hmm. that you're asking questions of meaning and questions of understanding about how our lives are, where they're going, what they mean. But it's more than that, again, beyond the meaning. And I like to talk of my poetry as a sort of ministry of meaning. Mm. And of course, with the pun intended, the ministry mm-hmm. of meaning. I also would say that there is a question, and this is a word beloved of my friend David Ford, the theologian, is wisdom. I think, was it Robert Frost said, I think that poetry begins, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but it begins with observation and ends in wisdom. Mm-hmm. And he was right. There is no formula for life, but we have to all the time seem to use our discernment to see patterns, to see, to find our way through this labyrinth of life, which. And so I think, again, the artist, and in particular, of course, the poet, has this in common with the theologian, is trying to use discernment to see, to put things in a context, and to see ultimately what's happening. I think even I would go further again and say there's possibly another dimension which would be in common, and I'm really here trying to unravel what Patrick Kavanagh meant, is sense of praising, which I think is part of what a theologian does, but I also think it's part of what an artist does, and what in particular a poet does, delighting in the depth and the richness of the universe, simply just for its own sake, delighting in it. And I would like, certainly in my poetry, to have that element, to have that dimension where you exult in existence, exult in the richness, the profundity, the variety, the opulence of living. And I think maybe I'd add a fourth dimension to it, which might be, I suppose for a theologian, it might be looking at the truth, trying to tell the truth. I think an artist, again, and in particular a poet, is trying to bear witness to the experience that you've had of the world, and to bear witness to it for other people. After all, most people, I think, when they read a poem, why they respond to it is because something is happening that they recognize, but they're too busy in their lives. Mm. They have seen this, they have spotted it, but they have let it go. The the artist or poet in this case doesn't let it go. He tries to grab the moment, tries to shape it, tries to for other people. And I think that's what the artist does for a society, is to grab these moments, which everybody sees. Otherwise they wouldn't respond to them, to the poems. But they bear witness to them.
And there's something quite amazing about that recognition then, when something is lifted up like that, and you realize, yes, that's true, when you don't necessarily take the time yourself. So that's something that I think theologians and poets both do all the time, huh?
Yes, I've given you a very long-winded answer, but I think it I think the question is profound enough to deserve a long
Absolutely.
Answer.
I'm curious about, well, you have a very deep knowledge of words, not only primarily as a poet, but also you began as a linguist, and you also speak a number of languages, and you have a sense of words that is different than most of us, I would say. And what I'm interested in is how this has influenced how you speak with people outside of poetry circles. And I'll tell you why I'm asking, partially because I'm interested in also how theologians talk to people outside of their circles, right? I think there's a parallel here. And so I'm very curious about this.
Well, there's I suppose let me answer the first part and then come back, and you may have to remind me the second part when I get there, but it seems to me that yes, I probably would say the parallel I would use, like a sculptor who knows his geology. Mm. In other words, a person who works in stone but knows his geology, knows what the grain of the stone is, knows where it comes from and so forth. And I suppose the fact that I did choose deliberately to train as a linguist means that I would know a lot about etymology. When I use a word, I'm conscious of where that word mm-hmm. comes from. Mm-hmm. And I do speak several languages. That also, I think, gives you a perspective, because it gives you a whole sense of the semantic field of words and so forth. It changes from language to language. So I think it ups your consciousness. It's a conscious raising exercise for a poet to actually know the mechanics and to know the etymologies that lie behind language. So I think I would have a certain consciousness of that, all right. Now, how that affects my talking to people outside of poetry, I'm not so sure. I suppose it means that I'm conscious of words when I use them. I mean, I would be very conscious of it. I mean, I laugh at myself, because when I'm in an American restaurant, and it has now come to Ireland as well, because it spreads through the television, it spreads through all those sort of media. I couldn't, for instance, ever say to somebody, enjoy. For me, it was a transitive verb as I grew up. It was enjoy yourself or enjoy the food or enjoy something. It was a transitive verb. And so that sort of thing is very, very conscious in me, even when I'm in conversation, when I'm talking to people. But primarily, when I'm talking to people, I'm trying to understand them. I'm trying to listen. I'm trying to communicate with them. So if it helps to pick the right word when communicating with people, but after all, it is relationships is what it's about. It's not about language. It's about relationships. But sometimes to be able to choose the right word for somebody can be a help to allow them to articulate something. But you have to be careful too, because sometimes I jump in with the word too soon.
Yes,
because the words are coming so fast to me that I'm inclined to sometimes jump in and get the wrong word and put people off. But sometimes it helps, I think, to help people, to aid people to articulate what they want to say, to be able to present them with the word. I suppose that's the nearest answer I can make. I don't quite get the parallels to theology that you're thinking of.
Yeah, I guess part of it was, I'm thinking, sometimes we have insider language, at least in the States. I've noticed this.
Eschatology and things like that, you mean? Is that it?
Right. Yes. And there's the way theologians talk to each other. And as with any field, right, you take for granted, you get your sort of insider speak.
Yes, there is. There's always a jargon associated, which becomes a sort of shorthand.
Yeah.
But it can easily become a Mandarism. And that's what you don't really want, I think.
There's another reason why I was asking about the choice of words and how important that can be. And this has to do with pastoral care. And I was speaking with a chaplain who also writes poetry. He's a chaplain supervisor, so he has students. He has these theology students that come and do units with him. And he was saying how words do matter, and how when you're listening to patients, it's not enough to just, when you're using very bland words, they can feel like they're not being heard. And when you say something, when you, whether it's a metaphor, whether it's the type of word that you use or some sort of analogy, that's the difference between them feeling that they're being heard or not. I'm really interested in anything that you could say to students or to chaplains or pastors who are going about this, the business of visiting and being with people in these trying times.
Well, I find that very hard to answer in many ways because I, you know, I haven't been in that position except on a personal basis, in other words, with people that I love. Mm-hmm. And in particular, over the last 3 years, before my wife died, when she had advanced Parkinson's, I was dealing with it and in a home with her every day for 3 hours. So I was dealing with people all around me who were suffering, and it, I suppose for me the first thing, of course, is to see the people as full people, because often I think when people go into maybe not carers, maybe not people in clinical pastoral care, but when you go in, your first instinct almost is to pull back, you know. Mm-hmm. And you see wheelchairs and you see walkers and you see walking sticks, but very soon you see faces and stories and people with lives and people with memories and so forth, and it's, I think really it's the acceptance of the person as a full person and not patronizing them in any way in their illness. And I would also say that, and I've seen this with Jean Vanier, who I've had the pleasure of meeting, the man who, as you will know, founded L'Arche. There's a great lot to be said, I think, for physical contact. Mm-hmm. An awful lot more can be said by an arm around somebody or touching somebody and listening than by trying to word things. I think you can get so much more across often by simply listening and laying a hand on somebody. Mm-hmm. Literally the laying of hands.
Yeah.
But the listening also is to the key words, because I mean, anybody, and even in, I suppose, in psychoanalysis, will say that to you, that you don't ignore the word that the person has chosen themselves, because it's revealing something. And being alongside somebody with love, I don't think there's anything else but love, really, to be alongside people with love. Obviously, if you're a professional, I'm sure there has to be some sort of reserve that you keep, or otherwise you'd burn out, but it's still, you cannot professionalize it to the point, I think, of not loving somebody. As I said, my experience comes out from dealing with my beloved, my late wife, but I'm sure that you know, unless the only listening is really is loving and understanding.
And could you also say something personally about how did writing poetry and reading poetry, was that helpful? Was that to you in relationship to illness?
Well, I mean, I think it's even, the question is more general in the sense that I think that as an artist, as a poet, how I've come through life, how I've managed to deal with life at every phase has been the need, and it's a compulsion, an absolute, it's the sweet compulsion, but it's still the compulsion to try to make sense of it, to try and shape it, and to try and share it with others. And I think that's what I hope poetry is doing. So at every stage of my life, in every stage of growth, every stage of understanding, I have had that need to try to shape it, express it in such a way that it can be shared, and I hope enrich others. So that this period is no exception. The way I would come through anything is to try to shape it, and to try to find meaning in it, to find wisdom of some sort to deal with it, and to bear witness to it. So all of those things come into play. I mean, I remember when my beloved Deeds had to go into a home, which I mourned almost as deeply when that happened as when she died. It was a very traumatic after all our years together. I remember somebody saying to me, you better go to a support group and talk to people and so forth. And I said, no, that's not as how as a poet I will handle it. I will handle it as I've handled everything else. I will try to give try to share it with others by expressing it in form and shape, and try to discern the patterns of wisdom that can be seen, the understanding, the sympathy, the compassion, and to give expression to that as best I can as a poet.
As a poet, for students who are in this process, who are juggling all of the things that are that they're learning and juggling right now, do you have some reading recommendations for them?
Well, I wouldn't dare to advise students as what to do. I mean, I've no notion what to advise them to do. But I would, I suppose, dare to say that I think people who used to say that a culture is measured by its poetry readers, and obviously I have a vested interest in this as a poet, but it's the ability to read heightened language, to engage with heightened thought and emotion, and I stress it's both thought and emotion, in the physicality, in the actual physical expression through words in a poetry, I think is something which keeps a heart open. And so I would presume that people in this particular situation, which I mean, who am I to advise anybody how to deal with church and world, but I would think just generally keeping in touch with themselves, keeping in touch with their own emotions, with their own thought, with their own relation to the world, would be heightened and increased and enriched by poetry. And I think that's all I could say. Obviously, I have a vested interest in saying that as a poet, but I do honestly believe that when people lose. And it amazes me that anybody who deals with life and the questions of meaning, as theologians do, it amazes me that if they don't read poetry.
A lot of times people make this conclusion when you say poetry and preaching, they think about including a poem in a sermon. And that's not what I mean at all. I mean exactly what you have said, which is it keeps your own language sharp for the writing of sermons, the writing of prayers, the way you're working with the liturgy, the more that you're reading, the more that's going to influence the way that you're articulating that for your congregation.
I don't think it's either or in that case. I mean, I agree with you that, you know, I don't think it should be confined to the idea of just quoting poems. I mean, people have said to me there's an index with my collected poems, and therefore you can look up words like love or friendship or whatever. So if you are actually presumably making a sermon that and there's a particular theme, it can be handy to look up and use a quotation. And after all, you know, there's no harm in using a quotation. It is heightened language. It may often affect your congregation or your public or whatever if you're speaking to use a quote. I have a friend of mine who is president of a university. Does it? He very seldom gives. In fact, they ask him now, you know, where was the poem if he doesn't quote a poem. In a speech, but people love it. They find it very moving to do that. So I wouldn't say it's an either or. But the point I was making, and which you obviously agree with, it is also a question of keeping yourself in terms of your own awareness of yourself, of your spirit, of your heart, of your emotions, and your thought, and bringing those together. It keeps those alive to be a poetry reader.
Yes.
But I don't think you've got to choose between that and quoting.
Right, yes. Right. Yes. Well, I would like to ask you to read something from your collected poems.
Certainly. I think I'd like to read for you a love poem. I think it's appropriate because you have been speaking about illness, and I have mentioned my late wife, so I think it would be appropriate on those grounds to read a love poem, but also because I think that it's something that we all share, this need to love and be loved. And there's very few people, and I'm sure nobody listening to this has gone through their teenagers without at some stage at least trying to write a love poem, because that's how people reach for it, and when they're overcome by their emotions as teenagers, some of us never stop. So let me read a love poem, which is called While You Are Talking. while you are talking, though I seem all ears, forgive me if you notice a stray see-through look. On tiptoe behind the eye's frontiers, I'm spying, wondering at this mobile you. Sometimes nurturer, praise-giver to the male, caresser of failures, Mother Earth, break water to my vessel. Suddenly you'll appear frail. In my arms I'll cradle you like a daughter. Now, sole pilot, and I confess, redemptress, turner of new leaves, reshaper of a history, then the spirit turns flesh. Playful temptress, I untie again ribbons of your mystery. You shift and travel as only a lover can. One woman, and all things to this one man.
It's beautiful, thank you.
I presume that when people go out on internships and so forth, they're dealing with people who are senior to them, people who are senior are dealing with people who come in internships or into more junior posts. And it strikes me that in institutions, in universities, it's true. It's true in any institution, but it must be very true in the world in which people who have been at the seminary work as well, is that it's so easy for people to not be encouraged, not be given approval of by the people who are senior to them. And I think always that it's the people who approve are the people that affect and remember it. I don't mean just boosting their egos and so on. Approval and praise means assessment as well as just simply boosting. There's often a tendency for senior people, I think, to be somewhat on the qui vive, a little threatened by people coming that are younger. And that relationship has always fascinated me. So perhaps this would be relevant to your audience. The poem is called Largesse. The generous sink into traces they leave in us. In tears of personality, gestures, words we use, flashbacks to small confirmations, that hand laying on a shoulder. The generous are still aglow within. Confident, they know nothing diminish their glory as they nourish seeds to flower for a while in me. The jealous, I begin to forget. Frightened spirits, nipping the bud of younger and younger threats. The turning point, and I face both ways like Janus. Recall how terribly you needed praise. Then choose.
Thank you. A lot of people think of poetry as only having to do with personal experience.
Yes, and there is a sort of a cliche about it. It's still a romantic cliche. It comes from the romanticism that the poet is the tortured individual who is expressing all his pain and his torture and so on. And that is it comes from the romantic period. The poet pacing the boards and so forth and just pouring forth his soul and so forth, you know. I'm very suspicious of that as an image of a poet. In fact, I think it obscures, and often it goes on from romanticism into modernism, which is simply an internalization in many ways, as Charles Taylor, the philosopher, has pointed out, of romanticism. In other words, it becomes exploring the subconscious, exploring one thing another, but it has taken off somehow from community. It has lost community, lost its societal element. Now, there are great poets such as Robert Browning who refused to simply retire into the romantic or into the interiority, and also wanted a public domain for poetry. And I would certainly belong to that. I see poetry as not only being expressing obviously what's personal and intense, but only in the sense that it opens out towards community, in that it helps the community to understand itself. But also I would go further and say, and I have done this in my own work, as I was mentioning last night at the reading I gave, there's almost a pattern. It was pointed out for me that there was this pattern between collections are poems with themes which were intensely personal. For instance, I tried to face up to mortality and finitude in a book called Our Double Time, which was very personal. But I followed it by a book where I spent 4 years reading about the Holocaust and the Shoah, which was a very public theme in which I never, ever mentioned the word I in it. None of my feelings come into it. I thought that would have been to diminish the people who suffered in the Holocaust for me to bring in my particular take on it. It's all researched. It's all actually historically accurate. The same again. I wrote a book called Love Life, which was a celebration of at that stage being 36 years in love with the one woman. And then I followed it by Globe, which had to do with the processes of history and what is happening in the world with globalization, how the world changes and so forth, which is love again in many ways, but it's love in the public domain. So what I'm trying to say is that I will not cede poetry simply to the interiority or the romantic. I do believe it still has a role to play in society, that it should still help to form the imagination and help to shape the imagination of a community, of a society. And I'm sure here there are lots of parallels with theology. If you think about it in society, just as poetry is presumed to have to do with the personal tribulations of somebody, religion or faith is often the same. It's just something, it's a private matter. You look after that yourself. I don't think actually, but this is more for you and for people, for theologians to say, but I don't think it has simply to do with the individual. I think it has to do with community, with society. And I also think there's a place in society and a voice should be there for people of thought and with ethics and who have thought through things over a long tradition to be able to voice these things in the public domain. And I think the public domain needs this. So there may be parallels, in fact, between the way poetry can be so easily marginalized by being seen as I said, romantic. And in the same way, religion can be privatized by simply seeing as something personal, what you do in your bedroom. But I think both have a place in the public domain, and the society and community is diminished and impoverished without them.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are those of the individual speakers and are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.